everyone from IIDA Northland. Within forums, we highlight exceptional projects within our local area. And we want to continue celebrating the great work around us, so we have brought this new format for touring projects to you all. Please continue listening to this audio track, as well as taking a look at our supplemental project photography pamphlet. If you are able to travel to the site, it is open to the public, so go explore and admire the details you will shortly learn more about. The project that we are highlighting within this forums is the Westwood Hills Nature Center in St. Louis Park. This space was designed by HGA and constructed by RJM. We'll be hearing from the architects, interior designer, and client within this video. Please welcome Glenn, Andrew, Natalie, and Mark. For more information on the team and the partners of this project, take a look at our pamphlet. All right, now let's dive right in. To get things started, can you tell us a little bit about the previous nature center that was positioned on this site?
Sure. The Westwood Hills Nature Center was originally, the building was originally a 2,700 square foot building that we kind of likened to a one-room schoolhouse. So you might walk in if you're on a hike and discover, you know, a class of kids having a puppet show. And so there were these kind of disparate needs that were not being met because everyone was sort of on top of each other in the space. There was a real lack of staff support space there too. And so it just sort of came to a head, and the city had a master planning process for a new nature center to replace that facility.
One of the master plan things that came out was people loved the feel of the old building. It was small, but it was cozy and comfortable and warm, and the materials were not exciting, but it was a great feel. You walked in there and you felt like you wanted to spend time there, being that there wasn't room to spend time there. So that was like an underlying to create that here, which is kind of hard because it's pretty subjective. But I think that piece with the exhibits and the colors and everything, I think, and I'm asking people when I see them that have been to the old building, that pointed question, does it feel like the old building? And a lot of people are like, yes. They expect it very institutional. Mm-hmm. But they walk in and they see the gathering spaces and the lounges that we have created and the feel. It's like they want to spend time here, which is the ultimate goal, is we're not just about kids, we're about the whole community.
I think that's a really great point. And I know when people come through and tour this space on their own time, they're going to notice that there are spaces that are more kid-oriented, more community-oriented, more adult-oriented. Can you give us a little bit of information about the programming of this space and the user groups?
I mean, one of the big programmatic challenges or drivers, I guess, is to create those spaces for people to just hang out and be comfortable, mm-hmm. And not compete with the programming spaces, which are essentially classroom spaces or multi-purpose rooms. Mm-hmm. So that's why you see, you know, we have a lounge space. We've got the taxidermy from the old building up. A fireplace, you know, those kinds of things are the types of cues that people might really engage with. In life.
When you're working on a public project like Westwood, there can be quite a diverse user group. Can you dive into those a little bit more?
That's a good question. I mean, the intended user groups are, you know, there's sort of different tiers of user groups. There are the staff of naturalists that work here. So, you know, we worked with them really closely to develop like the design of the raptor cages and raptor care spaces, for instance, so that we were including all of the elements that were necessary for, you know, the proper care of those animals, and also to have a nice working space. You know, they used to be really one on top of the other. And so now we've, you know, organized them in terms of programming storage and just workspace generally in the building, to make it a better work environment. There are also users that we didn't necessarily engage with, but kind of relied on our staff liaisons, Mark and others, to help us understand how, you know, school groups were going to use the spaces, how the public would use the space, those sorts of things. So there were a lot of voices in the room that could kind of account for all the different potential users and visitors to the Nature Center.
So as you learned a little bit from the existing site, what were some of the goals that were brought forward then for the new project?
A zero energy was an overarching sustainability goal for the project. I mean, that was the stated goal in the request for proposals, and so we had to address that. There are all sorts of other goals too. Stormwater management is a huge aspect of this site, you know, where the lake is surrounded by wetland. The soil geology here is sort of old wetland and peat bog, and it's pretty, it's a difficult site to build on. But that story of the land is part of the interpretive mission of the Nature Center. Another aspect of the building that was kind of a part of our marching orders, including the zero energy, was to use the building as a teaching tool in and of itself. And so we really took those two overarching goals, the zero energy, the building as a teaching tool, and tried to maximize those through the design of the building.
You mentioned one of the goals being having a net zero building. Can you explain a little bit to everyone listening what a net zero building exactly is?
So what is a net zero building? A net zero is a building that produces as much energy as it uses over the course of a year. So in any given month, like today is a really good example. It's snowing out. We got several inches of snow. The solar panels aren't generating any power. We just checked it on the screen. But over the course of the year, those solar panels are designed to generate as much, if not a little bit more, electricity than what the building will require for all of its building systems, HVAC systems, lighting, heat lamps for the reptiles and the animal tanks, etc.
So this idea of creating a net zero building, it sounds like it really needs to be a collaborative process, that it's more than just the architectural team. Can you elaborate on who's involved with this?
Yeah, so because the building is net zero, we kind of had to pull out all the stops. We have an integrated team of its architects, interior designers, landscape architects, engineers. We all had to use the zero energy lens when we were making decisions for the design of the building. So what that resulted in is how the building is oriented on the site. It stretches out east to west to maximize solar exposure, especially for the winter, where we welcome the sun into the building, and we'll look at that detail probably as we walk through. Also to maximize access to wind. The prevailing winds are kind of northish, southish in this climate, and also in this microclimate that's created by the clearing of the parking lot. We've got that solar exposure and the wind exposure from that we can take advantage of in the building.
And what are some of the complexities that come with making this building net zero?
Like I mentioned, you kind of have to pull out all the stops. Every discipline needs to take that zero energy goal seriously in the design of their systems. So we have, for instance, a geothermal well field that serves as a heat sink for the HVAC system and the radiant heat system. We have radiant floors in the building. We really took the set points, the temperature at which you set, you know, the thermostats at. We took that very seriously, because if you can lower thermostat settings in the winter and raise them in the summer, you can save a lot of energy. And that's kind of a behavioral thing. It's a design thing, but it's also, you know, has to do with what Mark Aestreich and his staff, how they manage themselves in this building and what their, you know, comfort level is and that sort of thing. A good example of that, and I pointed this out earlier, we have ceiling fans in several of the spaces here. That's so that you can control just the comfort level in that space. You don't have to, you know, change the thermostat setting. You can just get a little bit of air movement for comfort. And so I liken it to task lighting. It's sort of task cooling or task heating.
All right, Glenn. So we spoke about the building being a teaching tool. So what if the user wants to know more about the systems that are behind closed doors?
We can't necessarily, you know, reveal them very directly, but we have provided some moments like this window on the floor, windows into the electrical room and the mechanical room, so that, you know, if there is a group walking through here on an interpretive program, those things can be pointed out to them in a little bit more detail.
I think there's actually a really great example of that when you're walking down the corridor past the restrooms and you see this basically glass cutout in the floor. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So this cutaway window in the floor reveals the radiant floor system, which is a series of pipes that runs with hot liquid in it that heats up the floor slab and makes the floor comfortable. So you can see there's some rebar in the green and the red of the piping running through the slab.
So we talked about some of the complexities of making this building net zero and talked about the goals a little bit. Now can we dive into, you know, what are some other challenges that came from this project that you guys learned a little bit more about?
Another challenge was it's not an office building or a typical project that we can sort of approximate loads as a design team. I think it was a new project type. You're managing animal cages, animal comfort. There's other sort of, I think, programmatic elements that were added in that was a challenge throughout design that maybe wasn't just a typical thing like, oh, we know what a work surface or a workspace needs, or a break room needs this. You know, we can calculate that pretty easily from our historical projects. I think it was sort of doing a one-off building. We had to double, triple check, work closely with the nature center on what their cages were, exactly what the cages were, what they were going to be doing in the animal care rooms, et cetera. So what the exhibits, what the electrical loads of the exhibits were going to be, like those sort of things were integral to the design process.
Yeah, the Raptor Muse are a really unique space, not just the support spaces for them, which are pretty interesting. And we actually, you know, when we walk through the building, you'll see there are windows into some of these support spaces. So that's part of the interpretive, you know, building as a teaching tool concept, so that, you know, a kid can look and see one of the naturalists, you know, feeding a bird or preparing, you know, meals or whatever for those animals. The Raptor spaces themselves, we worked with the U of M Raptor Center, and Mark, and you know, Mark and his staff have expertise in this too. I think the most surprising thing that came out of that effort for me was the need for insect screens for those spaces, because disease is spread through mosquitoes.
Those mosquitoes can't leave any of us alone, can they? Before we dive into the interiors a little bit more, Andrew, can you give us an overview of some of the concepts of the exterior design?
You know, architects, interior designers, I guess I'm casting a broad brush, but we let, you know, you have one wood, you have one brick color, you have one metal color, and we sort of use these throughout a building to be consistent. On this project, we ended up with multiple wood species, and I think some of that came out of economics and material availability. You know, we have wood windows on the project, and so we were only able to get certain species of wood for the wood frames and the wood jamb extensions. We chose the glulam structure of the building for certain properties that were more important for the sort of not only the weathering and the exterior, the structural capabilities, the weathering, et cetera, that we didn't want to choose a material that matched the windows perfectly. And then as well, we have some feature wood walls in the exhibit space as well as into the lounge to sort of further bring warmth and sort of a feature element to the space. And that, again, the color of the pine wood windows or the Alaskan yellow cedar didn't seem to fit that that design element. And so I think we sort of over time embraced this idea of multiple woods in a space is okay. And I think that fits the idea of nature as well. There's multiple species of tree. I mean, at its basic form, there's multiple species of tree in the forest. And so here, you know, we tried to embrace that as well. And I think we were sort of diligent. It's not like we lined different wood species up next to each other. You know, we sort of deployed them in different ways, but I think they interact well together. And so that was something that I think over time evolved, and we got more and more excited about when it's something I think you resist over a normal project of adding more versus taking away. So
one other
feature of the building is the exterior design. We went through many iterations and ended up with cement board siding, and that was sort of twofold. It was durability and low maintenance, and you know, it was also to protect from woodpeckers and other insects or things like that. And so with that, cement board siding is typically a residential application. I guess there's large format flat panels, but we wanted to bring some life and texture to the exterior of the building, and sort of taking cues from nature, we used a lap siding as well as a flat panel with joints. And we used those throughout the building and sort of allowed them to adapt to the different shapes and forms of the building. I think many times in architecture, you pick a brick and you design a window jamb, and you're rigidly stuck to that around the building. And you run into problems when you turn a corner or things like that. And we spend so much time trying to make everything the same or one condition. And you end up creating 50 conditions that look like one, but they're really hard to detail and really technically hard and expensive. Where this, we sort of let the building evolve as we went around, and there's not really one side that's exactly similar to the other. And so we let sort of the patterns and textures evolve and change throughout the building and sort of adapt to the different conditions that we came across. And I think that starts to move to the interior as we get to some of the interior materials.
And I think that's a perfect segue to talk about the interior of the space. Natalie, can you give us a little more information about the concept and the materiality that went into the interior design?
Yeah, so concept for the interior started by really letting Minnesota kind of lead the way in terms of concept. So there was another interior designer on the project as well, kind of when I was brought on. And one thing we talked about was that, it's probably going to feel really earthy and neutral at the end. But actually what we did was we thought, like, what if you take kind of an architectural section of Minnesota? What would that look like? And what would it look like if you did that in all four biomes? So if you kind of sliced through a coniferous forest and you looked at the bedrock and the sediment all the way up through kind of the roots and the leaves on the ground and the trees and the sky and the animals and everything in between, if you did that in all four biomes, what would it look like? And we were actually surprised by the amount of color that we found in that. Coming a lot through kind of like the flora and the fauna and everything. So the palette we started with was actually very colorful and very bright. And then from there, it was, like Andrew said, just letting the building evolve a little bit and paring things away that weren't necessary and zoning in on a color story that felt subtle, but really kind of deliberate about where we placed it and why we used it. So you'll see, you know, in the corridor that's supposed to be, I believe it's the prairie grassland area, the tile shape we went with feels either kind of like a fish scale that might be in a brook or a stream, or it feels kind of like the feather plumage that might be on a pheasant in that area. And we needed tile to protect that wall anyway. We weren't adding materials just to add materials. So in the end, you know, the building itself is pretty neutral because it's all about kind of just maximizing the views to the exterior and letting all of the outdoors just really be the main focus of the building itself.
It sounds like you had a really clear vision and concept for the space. How has that affected once you started working with these other consultants?
So Split Rock Studios were the designers for the exhibit space, kind of the main part of this building. And just knowing that they were going to be such a focal point, we wanted to make sure that we were in communication with their team. But ultimately, they did, you know, have the lead and control over it. So just throughout the process, we were sending them images of our kind of inspirational palettes, sent them a few samples of the major finishes of the building. And then we just kind of saw their graphics as they were developing those, gave them a little bit of feedback there. But ultimately, keeping that main space neutral for them would just allow their layer of exhibit space to work in and not be in conflict with anything with the building.
It's really interesting how this collaboration took place between HGA and the exhibit designer. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on this process?
We sent them paint samples so that they would have kind of like our main paint colors and then all the accents. And then we had a little bit of back and forth about the main colors that they use kind of in the background, like swaths of the exhibits on some of the walls. had just some conversation there just to talk about making sure that, you know, there's a lot of color on the exhibit, so making them feel a little bit more elevated, but still kind of getting kids excited when they see them. So finding that right balance between having a space that's for adults just as much as it's for kids.
We also had our city brand incorporated into that too, with both Split Rock and with our jam, so those three kind of all melded together.
It sounds like this was truly a very smooth partnership. How was this partnership facilitated?
When we got the contract with HDA to do this, and then we were searching for an exhibit designer, they were like, well, who's your exhibit designer? And we didn't have someone under contract yet. And they're like, they need to be at the table at the first meeting. And so that was really important that that was the key focus, like Natalie said. And the building's kind of built in balance with that or around that, rather than the typical is you just put an exhibit in whatever space you have and it doesn't work. So when you look at that space, I mean, it blends so perfect, just the angles and how everything fits in there. But that was intentional because Split Rock had to be at the table, and they were at actually the first planning meeting we had and every meeting since then. So I think knowing that's an important thing in a type of building like that, or like we have here, otherwise you could end up with not as successful, I think.
I mean, do you have to do it that way? No.
No.
You could build a building and then someone could come in later, but it's just not going to be as integrated and maybe not as effective.
Talking a little bit more about partnerships, Andrew, can you touch base a little bit about the integration of local art within this project?
So there will be art, commissioned art throughout the building, and one of those pieces that is truly integrated with the building is there's artwork between the two panes of glass that we then integrated into the interior. But the way I've started to describe it to people when I've given tours is it's a very reminiscent pattern of the UV pattern of the Frit glass. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to see the UV bird safe glass with the naked eye. If you get at a certain angle and certain sunlight, you can kind of see up through the glass and you can see the pattern. But that art glass is a very good replication of what that spider web pattern looks like, which was kind of, I think, a happy accident in the project.
So you just mentioned UV glazing and Frit glazing. Can you go into a little bit more depth about the importance of these elements?
So I think one of the main features or one of the design features is the bird safe glazing on the exterior. We utilized two types of bird safe glazing. One has a ceramic frit pattern, and the second has a UV coating that is visible only to birds. And so we utilized these two types for a couple of reasons. One, for educational purposes, to show people there's different ways to protect birds from the glazing, and as well as to preserve views out into the nature. That's one of, you know, the missions is there's bird watchers, there's educational pieces in the exhibit that we wanted to tie to the outdoors. And so one of those things is to be able to clearly see out. And so we utilized the Ornolux glazing, which has the UV coating on the lower bands of certain spaces so that you got direct views out. And then in some of the upper spaces or the upper windows, we use the Frit.
Yeah, and that Frit pattern is the horizontal lines. You know, they're guidelines for how to create Frit patterning for bird safe glass. And generally speaking, it's a 2-inch by 4-inch grid. That would be like the ideal pattern, which isn't necessarily great, but so what we've done is just use the horizontals.
The standard is like a max of 4 inches.
Yeah.
And so we, to sort of elevate that slightly, we turned them horizontal and then spaced them roughly 2 inches apart.
Wow, there seems to be a lot going on with exhibit consultants, the local artists, etc. Where were you as a design team able to bring in some very impactful design details?
We took the opportunity of really small architectural details that would be in the building naturally. So things like expansion joints in concrete, we need to have those. And then we kind of decided to express them with brass instead of an epoxy that would match the concrete. And the inspiration behind that was actually an image of a controlled prairie burn. So it's this really kind of bright blaze that slices through the landscape. And so that's kind of where that stemmed from. And then even subtle things like just putting tips of color on coat hooks that's where we bring in the color of like animals and plants that you find just naturally in these biomes, and letting those little bright spots of color catch your eye as you walk throughout the building.
All right, and to wrap up this conversation, while everyone is walking through this space on their own time, how can they know which biome within the concept they are walking through?
We did some custom signage for each room to help divide up and make sure that every biome was represented. So we did some really quick studies just internally of how to represent each of those in kind of a really minimal way. So this one represents the coniferous forest. But if you go around, you'll see that deciduous, prairie grassland, and tall park aspen are all represented just through the room signs.
And that's all we have for you today. Thank you again to HGA, the staff at the Westwood Nature Center, and all of our IIDA Northland sponsors that make opportunities like this possible. Now go out, explore the Nature Center, and experience all of the beautiful design in our community. Thank you.